implementing the financial reform bill isn't the only big task looming for the federal government. In the next year, the government needs to fill an estimated 50,000 entry-level positions. This past week, recruiters from 85 federal agencies set up shop at a job fair in Washington, D.C. NPR's Carolyn Beeler was there, along with more than 7,000 people, looking for work.
Carolyn Basala is standing in a line that snakes around one of the massive columns at the National Building Museum. She arrived in Washington, D.C. from Arizona just hours before the job fair began.
I got an email on Monday, actually, saying, hey, there's a career fair. It's the largest federal career fair ever. So I made very last-minute arrangements, hopped on a plane last night, flew 12 hours, and changed planes three times.
That's dedication, or, as Basala calls it, desperation. With a 9.5% unemployment rate, lots of people have been feeling that desperation. Basala has been waiting in line to talk to the CIA for 45 minutes. She's holding a folder filled with copies of her resume, and she's wearing one of the three work dresses she found a couple months ago.
I bought them all because I figured I should build my work wardrobe a little bit before I get a job. I just never thought I'd have this much time to build it.
Basala graduated from the University of Arizona in December, and she's applied for about 70 government jobs. She wants to use her background in Middle Eastern studies to work in intelligence, and she knows she wants to work for the federal government.
Because it's such a stable job and has great salary and great benefits, I mean, it's appealing.
A lot of people at the job fair say the most important thing is that with the government, there are jobs.
How you doing, sir? My name is Taj Glenn.
Taj?
Yes.
Nice to meet you.
And I'm crazy about the environment.
Taj Glenn is talking to a recruiter from the Environmental Protection Agency. He also visited the Postal Service booth and plans on talking to some recruiters in the healthcare field. When I asked him what his dream job is, his answer was more practical than aspirational.
My dream job is a job that's going to keep me financially stable and that's going to keep the bills paid.
There was a time when young people dreamed of jobs with big bonuses. In the 1987 movie Wall Street, the character Gordon Gekko told people that making money was the ultimate goal.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Today, many people are saying that a regular paycheck is what works. Max Steyer is the head of the Partnership for Public Service, the nonprofit that organized the job fair.
The federal government, unlike an internet startup, better not go bust. So we need our federal government to survive and thrive, and in that sense, it's definitely stable.
Entry-level hiring in the federal government has been steadily increasing over the past 5 years as the oldest baby boomers begin to retire.
The government has the oldest workforce of any sector and therefore will experience the baby boom retirement wave earlier and faster than any of the other sectors.
As job openings increase, though, so will applications. The online process for applying for a federal job is being revamped to make it easier, and that's expected to increase application numbers even more. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama traveled to Holland, Michigan this past week to celebrate the groundbreaking of a new plant that will make batteries for electric cars. While the president talked about economic engines of the future, NPR's Scott Horsley spent some time thinking about the power of the past.
President Obama says it's more than just a factory that's taking shape in Holland. It's a down payment on a whole new industry.
These have been a tough few years, but we have been through tough times before. And at our best, we've risen to the challenges we face by tapping the drive and the talent and the ingenuity that has always been at the heart of America's success.
Evidence of Michigan's ability to weather tough times is on display just a mile down the road from the battery plant. Parked in the middle of a well-tended flower bed sits an antique Alice Chalmers steam engine, just like the one that was showcased in the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. That's where some Holland businessmen saw it and bought one for their city's Bush and Lane piano factory.
Way back when, after horses and everything and the steam engines drove all of these plants.
That's Dick Darby of the Holland Historical Trust. Steam power drove the piano plant for almost a quarter century until the music stopped abruptly in 1929.
People are trying to figure out how to buy groceries and not pianos when the stock market crashed. I'm sure that had something to do with it.
The steam engine sat idle until 1933. Then the New Deal put Americans and the old Alice Chalmers back to work. This time, the 350-horsepower steamer was harnessed to the belts and pulleys of the Baker Furniture Company. It ran two shifts a day for another 26 years before it was finally retired in 1959. Coal trains still rumble through Holland, connecting the city's past to its future. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm says this area that once turned lumber into furniture is now turning in a new direction.
Our goal is to transform Michigan from the Rust Belt to the Green Belt.
A few years ago, some civic volunteers cleaned the rust off the old Alice Chalmers engine, gave it a fresh coat of paint, and propped it by the side of the road as a symbol of their city's industrial heritage. Workers will pass by it on their way to the new battery plant, and they'll know, once they get up a good head of steam, the people of Holland, Michigan, still have the power to make things. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This week, President Obama is expected to sign the Dodd-Frank bill passed by the Senate last week. The bill will transform the banking and insurance industries, imposing dozens of new laws aimed at preventing the kind of market meltdown that has left the economy so badly damaged. But the process of overhauling the financial system is only partly finished. Over the next 18 months, regulators will carry out a complex process called rulemaking, where the real details of the new bill will get thrashed out. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Timothy Ryan heads the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, and he knows a thing or two about the way laws get written. Ryan was involved in the savings and loan bailout in the late 80s, and he says there has never been anything like the task facing regulators over the next couple of years.
So we're now going to go into this unprecedented time period. There is no time in the United States history where we have had this type of legislative change and this number of regulatory requirements placed on these agencies.
The problem is this. The bill passed by the Senate this week amounts to a kind of outline of what should happen in many of the most important areas of the financial services industry, like securitization and derivatives. But it will be up to federal agencies like the Treasury Department and the SEC to fill in the details. For example, the bill creates a council to oversee financial firms that are so big their demise would cause a risk to the whole financial system, and that council can dismantle firms that get in trouble financially. But it will be up to regulators to decide which banks qualify as too big to fail. There are thousands of issues like this that need to be addressed. Attorney Seth Grosshandler of the law firm Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton points to another. The bill allows U.S. regulators to dismantle troubled financial institutions and dispose of their assets. But what about those companies' foreign subsidiaries?
That's the really thorny issue, and this legislation doesn't really deal with it. It puts it into a study. Right, but I mean, everyone knows this is no secret. The regulators know that the cross-border aspects are very, very important to figure out what to do, but that's not a quick thing.
Grosshandler was one of several hundred people who turned out on Thursday for a conference in New York on the new legal landscape. Many of those attending were lobbyists eager to put their stamp on the new rules. For big Wall Street firms, there is a lot of money involved. Charles Johnston is president of Morgan Stanley Smith Barney. He says this is a new era for the financial markets. U.S. regulators have made clear that companies can still sell the same products to their investors, but they have to be more transparent.
There's got to be more accountability, and the real unanswered question is, what's the definition of that accountability? And it's too early to tell, but that's why the industry's got to have a voice in this and try to be a good partner and get to the right outcome for both our clients and for the industry.
Johnston says the new bill could be a good thing for investors if it leaves them feeling more confident about the markets, but they will be hurt if the regulations are too onerous and financial firms like his stop selling a lot of the products they offer now. Tim Ryan of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association says it's just too soon to tell what will happen.
It's unprecedented, so No one knows how long it's going to take. The statute gives them requirements, time requirements. Most of them are about 18 months to finalize this. Having had some experience in this area, it will not surprise me if this is pushed out a lot longer.
Much of this process will take place largely outside of public view. It's the kind of grinding detail work that tends to be ignored by the press. But for Wall Street companies, it can be a chance to try to shift the impact of the new bill in important ways, which means that for lobbyists, the real work has just begun. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
You might think it would be hard to make life more miserable for North Koreans, but their government did just that last fall when it tossed out its old currency and introduced a new one. Reporter Barbara Demick has traveled regularly to China's border with North Korea to seek out North Korean escapees to get a glimpse of what's happening inside their mysterious country. In the New Yorker magazine, Demick describes the disastrous consequences that flowed from the North Korean government's decision. We called her in Beijing to talk about it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, your article begins with a young woman, Song Hee, a girl really, barely 17 years old, who just escaped from North Korea by crossing the border into China. She wasn't starving. I mean, she had a couple of prized possessions, one of them an MP3 player. And you describe her family as part of North Korea's nascent middle class. Tell us a little about what that means, to be middle class in North Korea.
It's a funny word, middle class, by our standards, but it means that she was not starving. Her parents were very typical. Her father was an iron miner. Her mother was, like many middle-aged North Korean women, working at the market in these, you know, tiny businesses. Her mother was selling socks. The family was growing vegetables on their own plot in the mountain. So they were, you know, eking by an existence. Song Hee told me, you know, that she considered herself extremely privileged because she would occasionally get an egg to eat.
So these people, again, managed to raise themselves up. They were hit terribly hard by a currency devaluation that the government brought about last fall.
That's right. Overnight, basically, all their money was wiped out. You know, not very much money. We're talking about people who had maybe $100, $200 in savings. But by a North Korean standard, that was what was going to give them a future. It was going to give Song Hee a chance to go to college. And even though education is nominally free in North Korea, you have to buy books, you have to give gifts of cash to your teachers who are themselves not paid. And she had a sliver of hope for the future, as did some other North Koreans. And overnight, they were thrust back into the darkness of the worst period of the 1990s, when North Korea went through a famine. And that was the tragedy, that all the hard work that they had done to bring themselves up from that despair was lost overnight.
You talk about people having heart attacks and sort of nervous breakdowns when this happened, because it was so sudden and, even by North Korean standards, so cruel.
That's right. People were told in most towns about noon on a Monday that, you know, henceforth all their money would be basically garbage, just paper. And they had usually till the end of the day to turn in their money. And they would get new money dispensed that would be worth a dollar or two. It wasn't really clear what the value was. And so what happened was that, you know, anybody who was, you know, living above mere survival was completely wiped out. All that hard work and personal enterprise and the struggling, you know, wiped out immediately. And people freaked out. They collapsed. They killed themselves. They swore against the regime. Things like this had never happened.
What is the thinking on why the government did this?
From the perspective of the North Korean government, they saw the very notion of money, currency, as sort of antithetical to the socialist way of doing things. This is a very undiluted brand of communism, and you're supposed to be handed your house, your clothing, your food. You're not supposed to buy things for yourself. And the government hated the fact that people were working privately on the markets, buying their own food and having that level of economic freedom. And that's what they wanted to wipe out. And then there was another motive, is the North Koreans are doing these huge celebrations in 2012 to mark the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth. Kim Il-sung is the founder. And this 2012 business is like the Olympics. They want to rebuild Pyongyang, the capital, and they needed money and they didn't have it. So in effect, by destroying the money supply, the government can print new money and use it for its own purposes. So in effect, the net effect was confiscating everybody's money. It's a little bit of a sleight of hand. Actually, it's a lot of sleight of hand. It's a trick that they call currency reform.
Although somebody paid a price because this got out of hand.
That's right. And that's what's really unusual here. They've done this kind of trick before. In fact, I think this is the sixth time they've done it. This is what a North Korean economist told me. But this time, they faltered. They didn't have the confidence, and they actually had to apologize. And as I keep on saying, you know, being a totalitarian regime means never having to say you're sorry. But in this case, it went so bad. They said they were sorry, and then they made this old party cadre, Park Ki-nam, the scapegoat. He was executed. So this was, you know, very dramatic. And you know, the finding of fault with themselves really indicated a weakness.
Well, you do mention in the New Yorker article that North Korea watchers are now talking about the possibility of regime collapse. Do you think it's a bigger possibility?
Definitely, most definitely. And it's not just the currency reform. It's Kim Jong-il, the leader's poor health. He's had a stroke. He possibly has kidney disease or cancer. He's very thin. We saw him recently visiting in China, and we saw, you know, shocking footage of this leader who was famous for his, you know, jowly face and pot belly, looking very drawn. And he is behaving like somebody who's been given a deadline. They're having a very rare session of the Workers' Party in September, and that is believed to be an occasion to name his youngest son, whose name is Kim Jong-un, as his successor. This is a boy who's 27 or 28. We really don't know that much about him. And I think people are nervous about what happens next, and you can feel the fallibility and uncertainty and the hesitancy of this regime in a way that you couldn't a few years ago.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks. My pleasure.
Barbara Demick's article on the currency devaluation in North Korea is in The New Yorker. Her book is called Nothing to Envy: Ordinary Lives in North Korea.
Thank you.